She inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. We are game changers, doing the good thing, the right thing, not just for ourselves, but for all beings who call the Earth home. And we thank you for listening and for being a part of our world. And a big shout-out and thanks to the sponsor of this show, the Chapman Automotive Group. As a company and as a culture, they are committed to doing their share and showing they care about their employees, their community, and the planet. And that's due in a large part to their Community Green team. They are actively involved in year-long activities that impact both the internal operations of the company as well as the community through their hands-on philanthropy. One example of that is that they have donated almost 2,000 trees to a local nonprofit to be planted in public spaces throughout the city, and that benefits everybody. So a big shout out to them. And for more information about Chapman, please visit ChapmanTucson.com, and I hope you'll check them out. So we have yet another important and impactful show today. This is the fourth of a five-part series for the month of May, spotlighting women leading the change to address global warming. We believe that there is no better moment to focus on the issue of gender equality around the world than by raising the voices of brilliant women who are creating positive change by doing the good thing, the right thing, for all of us who do call the planet home. Joining us for this next hour is Diana Liverman, Regents Professor of Geography and Development and former co-director of the Institute of the Environment at the University of Arizona. Diana studies the human dimensions of global environmental change, especially the social causes and consequences of climate change. Her overreaching concern is the fate of the disadvantaged and disempowered in a changing climate, the poor, women, children, and other species. It's kind of like the same story. Diana, I'm so glad you're here. It's great to have you back. It's been way too long.
Thank you very much, Gina. It's great to be on again and to talk about things I care about.
Like really important things. I mean, I'm smiling. I wonder sometimes if our listeners can hear me smiling, so to speak, because I have a big grin on my face. And I'd like to start with a report that you published with Miriam Gay. Is it Antaki?
Yes.
That was published earlier this year, because I personally can't think of anything in my world more relevant and important than climate change for women, women in climate science. And I have a lot of reasons for that, including the highlight of the importance of educating women and girls in as a solution to reversing global warming that was highlighted in Project Drawdown, edited by Paul Hawken, and compiled in a very big way by senior writer Catherine Wilkinson. I think she had a lot to do with the very heavy lift.
You do know that Catherine was my PhD student.
I found that
out. I'm so proud
of her. It was like, I did the happy dance. Who would not be? I mean, talk about impressive. I hung on her every word.
Yeah.
And got to hear her present at Green Biz, and then when you had her do a presentation at the U of A.
Yeah, she's wonderful.
And brilliant, and very much aware of the whole gender conversation with women and climate change, and I'm proud of her for that. So tell us about the report and what your inspiration was for doing it. It really impacted me significantly because of the research. It wasn't necessarily making me do the happy dance, but I'm sure you're going to report how things are changing for the good.
Yeah. So the inspiration was actually Miriam, who everybody calls Mimi. She was doing her PhD with me at the University of Arizona. She's originally from Mexico, and her interest is very broadly women and climate change. And she'd been working, looking at how women were affected by climate change, what women were doing to respond to climate change. But we were looking at women on the ground in their communities. But we started to look at, well, what other angles are there on gender and climate science? And in fact, one of the things that inspired the visit was, you'll remember we had Mary Robinson come and speak to us in Tucson about 3 years ago.
Wow,
now
I remember that.
And it was talking to Mary, who has done a lot to promote both sort of helping women cope with climate change, but she's also done a lot to promote women as negotiators at the climate negotiations. And I said to her, well, what about the other group of sort of hidden women in the climate story, which is the women scientists who have contributed to our understanding of climate change? And she was like, yes, we haven't really looked at them as a community. And so it was inspired by Mary Robinson's visit that Mimi and I sat down and said, it would be really interesting to see what the experience of women climate scientists is. And so we decided to design a survey, and we thought, well, what's a sort of the right group to interview? And the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is, of course, the world's largest collection of climate scientists who are trying to contribute to our debate on climate change. And there are hundreds of them. And I said, well, why don't we take the sort of measure of leading women climate scientists as women who have been authors of IPCC reports? And so that was our sample. And we designed a survey. I was optimistic we'd get a good response for some reasons we can discuss. And we did get a good response. We got fascinating results. We very much wanted to publish the results somewhere where scientists would read the study, and both men and women scientists. And we tried one very distinguished journal and got rejected. but then we were fortunate to submit it to the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which is read by a lot of scientists. And the article was accepted. We had an editor who was very sympathetic to the paper. And we were really excited that it got published in a major scientific journal.
You know, a question that just really came into my head, you found a lot that we're going to talk about, and I guess I should save the question till later, but let's try to remember. Mm-hmm. What I have to guard against is when I see things that to me are obviously gender biased and women are being excluded from the conversation, maybe it's because I'm getting older. I find that with some men, it's not intentional. They're not even aware of the bias that they bring to the table. It goes to my experience about white privilege. If you're white, you experience white privilege. It's not a debate. You were born white, so therefore you have white privilege. But for these scientists, I don't always think it's a malicious, let's exclude women. They're clueless and they're involved in their research. Is that fair?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, a lot of a number of men have talked to me about the paper, including men at the recent IPCC meeting I was at. And, you know, they're very worried. They want to understand, well, you know, was there something in my behavior that made my female colleagues feel uncomfortable because I wasn't aware that there was a problem?
That's great, though.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, one of the important things about the paper, and I really do, Mimi is the lead author. She's the person who led the study, so I want to give her full credit. One of the things that was really interesting was also, it's not just that we were looking at the representation of women in these reports, we were looking at whether they had voice, and those are different. So even now, when IPCC releases the authorship list for their next report, which is about to start, they were very happy because they were able to say, oh, well, we now have, you know, X percent women. But I said to them, it's not just whether the women are authors, it's whether they get to speak and whether they have an influence on the content of the report. So that was partly what we were looking at. That was one of the most important things in the paper, was did the women feel as though they had voice, had influence? And then the other sort of important part of what we were trying to do, and I may be getting ahead of myself
no,
here.
No, it's awesome.
Which is we wanted not to have gender be a binary category. We wanted to look at this issue of the multiple disadvantages that some women experience. So we were looking at this issue of intersectionality, which is
that
where,
was one of my questions.
Yeah.
Explain that. That's
yeah.
really
so,
it's huge.
So what's important about intersectionality is that you experience disadvantages for multiple things associated with your identity. So it might be that you're a woman, but it could be that you're not a native English speaker. That was actually our biggest finding, was the disadvantages experienced by people who don't have English as or who don't speak English very well, but also people felt that they were disadvantaged because of their race or because they were social scientists as opposed to a natural scientist. So many things about our identity that can give us advantages, whether it's race, gender, class, caste, all of those. And what we wanted to understand was the multiple challenges that women were facing. The interesting thing about that is the response has been from some men who are men of color who aren't native English speakers, that this is my experience too. It's not just something women, and of course women have the extra disadvantage of being women, but many of those intersectional identities are also experienced by men as disadvantages.
And to me, it's what after I read the study and then read it again, what struck me is the importance of it, the significance of it, is that if women's voices and Indigenous people and non-English speakers, if their voices aren't being heard, we're not getting the full picture of the global warming situation. So it's like, right, not to in any way bash what's come out of the IPCC, but it's not a complete picture. That was the feeling I had, like the sinking in my heart. We're not getting the full picture of what's going on, which is why we dedicated this month to women climate scientists and women leading the, they're not all climate scientists, women, right, leading the charge. So I think it's really important for our listeners to know that how many scientists were surveyed, and there was a really impressive geographical distribution. You weren't just asking white women in the United States.
Right.
And that mattered to me a lot. So it was really a very representative sample.
Yeah. So it was quite hard to put together the initial sample. Mimi had to look at every IPCC report, and there have been five reports, but each time there's three different reports, hundreds and hundreds of pages.
Oh my gosh, she earned her PhD.
We had to look at the author lists, and one of the biggest challenges was in the first two rounds in 1990 and 1995, they only used initials. And so even identifying who the women were, it was helped by the fact that, you know, I've been around a long time and I know a lot
some of the
women.
Yeah, a lot of them, yeah.
But that was a challenge. We were Googling people to try to, like, find a picture of them to see if they were a woman or not. And it was especially challenging with some of the names from Asia, where we weren't, we didn't know the names of some of the female versus male names. But we did our best, and we came up with about 220 names. We then had to figure out where they were, because a lot of them weren't where they were 20 years ago. So again, lots of Googling, trying to find people. We found most of them. And then we had an online survey. We sent an email saying, please fill out the survey. And we were really happy with the response rate, because many surveys, you're lucky if you get 10 or 15% response rate, and we got almost 50% responses. So we got more than 100 responses. And it's funny, now the paper's come out, people have emailed me saying, can I fill the survey out now?
Please add to the research. But that's really awesome and shows, yeah, about impact. And there were some things that were positive in the report, little, you know, beacons of light as far as I'm concerned. But it did show an increase from 1990 of 5%, which was really awful.
There was like five women on the first report.
Five women in, yeah, the whole world. That's okay. To more than 20% in some of the recent assessment reports. Yeah. Is it getting better? Is it trending upwards, as I like to ask?
Oh, absolutely.
So that's...
I think that, our paper... you indicate that you found it a little bit depressing, but there's actually a lot of positive things that we found, more positive than we thought. I mean, one was there has been a big increase in the number of women. And I think there are two factors there. One is an awareness and even some messaging from IPCC that they would like to see governments nominate more women. And it's important to recognize that this is not, you can't blame the organization of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Right.
The way you become an author is you have to be nominated by your government. And so a lot of what women are struggling with is prejudices within countries that are not very supportive of women. So you have to get more countries to nominate women, and that is happening, but not in many. A lot of countries aren't doing the best job. And the second is just the number of women who are available. Now, it's not an excuse in 1990 that there weren't enough women to have more than five authors. I mean, I was around then. There were a lot of women climate scientists. Right. They might have been a little bit younger, but there were plenty around. So there are plenty to choose from. So I know that IPCC they've just done a round of nominations for the sixth IPCC report, which will be out in 2020 or so. And they were really frustrated because only 25% of the nominations were women. And then when they then pick more women than men, the governments are like, but, you know, you didn't pick the men that we nominated. So there's a big structural problem there that has to do with the status of women in different parts of the world in terms
over
of their
which
status
the IPCC has no control.
Right.
They have to go from who's nominated. Yeah. I want to read a really brief excerpt from the report. Several studies have examined the demographics of authorship of the IPCC reports and have shown that authorship leans towards the natural sciences, the more developed countries, non-Indigenous voices, and men. Share with us a little bit more in depth why leaving them out is so significant when it comes to the impact of global warming. It's just, I mean, we mentioned it, but go down a little bit deeper. If you're only hearing from a small percentage of the population in general, I mean, women are 51% of the population in the world, and the more people are poor, so there's a lot in that. So what happens in terms of what we do get to read and the research that does come out?
Well, I think there are several reasons it's important. One is you're missing a lot of expertise, and these reports are so pivotal in international climate policy and in the amount of publicity they get when they come out every 5 years, that if you're missing a big chunk of expertise, which is the women who are not there, and even worse, if you've got women there but they didn't have a voice, the way the report was written, their ideas were ignored, then you're missing a lot of knowledge. But I think there are a couple of other things. The importance of role models. Being an IPCC scientist is very prestigious. In 2007, the IPCC authors were involved in the Nobel Prize. And so you've got 2,000 people who can say they were associated with the Nobel Prize. And there aren't many women there. And think of the importance of that for younger women looking to the future. And then finally, I think that women are important when they go back to their country in terms of as educators and influencing policy. And women are often very important in organizing campaigns within their countries on climate change. And if they're not part of the science, then they're less informed when they go back and get involved in activism or trying to influence policy, or even working with the very powerful women decision makers that are out there.
And it's, you know, I think about what's happening in Ecuador, which, you know, is my passion, is the rainforest. And it is encouraging to see the groundswell, really and truly, of women leaders, which is so not a part of their culture. They are not. I mean, I spent weeks in the Amazon observing and being a part of that world, but they're finding their voices. And in Ecuador, especially, it's really having an impact.
Yeah, and if you can create a sisterhood where the activists, the decision makers, and the scientists who are women are working together, it's very important. I have one anecdote, which may or may not be significant, but two of the women political leaders who historically took climate change most seriously were Angela Merkel and Margaret Thatcher, who I didn't like for a lot of reasons.
What?
But on climate change, she was very good. And Margaret Thatcher and Angela Merkel both had scientific degrees And so a lot of people have suggested, and some people who I know Angela Merkel, have said that she took climate change seriously because she understood the science. I don't think there's a better example of how women scientists getting involved can have an impact.
No, that's perfect. A point at which to break. I didn't ask you this big question, then we have to go out for break. But everybody, please stay here with us. We're going to talk more about what the women's experiences were. Many, many more questions to come about women and climate change. Stay here with me.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and Speak Up networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
And welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is indeed Mrs. Green's World. Thanks for being a part of that world. Joining me for this hour is Diana Liverman, Regents Professor of Geography and Development and former co-director of the Institute of the Environment at the University of Arizona. And a little bit more about Diana's journey. I have to cut it down because I want her to answer all these questions, but she's done a lot. She is affiliated with the Environmental Change Institute and the Linacre College at Oxford University in the UK, and over her career, she has taught geography and helped to build interdisciplinary environmental programs at Oxford, Penn State, and the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Diana, once again, thanks for being here. I know that you have a lot on your plate, and taking the time to sit here with me for an hour is greatly appreciated.
You are very welcome.
Let's talk a little bit about, you had some open-ended questions, which once I read the report, I wanted to like read all their answers. I really did, because you gave them a chance to really voice what their experience was. What was the overall experience of these women with working with the IPCC? Was it full participation? Did they feel it was, you know, an equal opportunity for them? What did you find when you asked those questions about more in-depth about the experience?
Yeah, that was where we saw a real contrast, because in our very simple questions where we asked people to sort of rank things or check things off, what we found was that the majority of women who responded said that they had had a pretty good experience. I mean, about 80% said that their experience was mostly positive. But then when we gave them the opportunity to tell us, you know, more, write some sentences about their experiences, then we started to hear the real challenges that they face. So women actually telling us, well, that the lead author for my chapter didn't pay attention to me. My employer punished me for participating in IPCC. I lost income. I was a single mother, and it was very difficult for me to participate because of the travel. And so those, when we actually gave them voice in the open-ended questions, that was where we got stories that really, you know, make you sad that these women had to struggle so hard to participate. But I think one of the things that's made IPCC and others more receptive to our paper is that it's not overwhelmingly negative.
It isn't.
A lot of
it
women
really
are
isn't.
Reporting that
yes.
Being an IPCC author was fulfilling, that they were treated with respect in their chapter, and that it helped their careers.
So that's a huge positive, if you ask me. What about, you asked scientists whether gender, race specifically, ethnicity, language, youth, and nationality were barriers to their and other women's full participation. And I just have to reflect a little bit on the whole women's travel thing. And I feel like I have a very highly evolved marriage where we share tasks, and it's very different. From the beginning, we just did things differently. But still, when I traveled as the mother, there were things that I just naturally took care of, things like dental appointments and scheduling and all that. We call it the natural order of things in our family, even though we don't do a lot of
natural order of things.
It isn't. Right. We changed a lot of that. I mean, people, right. You know, we were the weirdo couple yeah. way back when. But that is a burden. And I'm blessed because of the relationship that I have. James didn't feel like he was babysitting. He was the father, which is very different. So that would put women at a disadvantage who probably have the primary responsibility, or if you're a single mom. So that impacts even the possibility of participating.
Yes, and I see women in particular, even now, you know, who I'm working with internationally, who are, you know, they're getting up at 3 a.m. to Skype to read a story to their kid. But it is also a problem for men increasingly, as men do take on more childcare. International collaboration and international networks do take you away from your families. And unlike in some parts of the private sector where you can take your family with you, that you might be supported by your employer, the funding that's available for IPCC is so limited. They don't even have enough money to support many of the authors to participate. So there are people who are paying for their partner to come with them, or for their mother to come with them, so that they can travel with a tiny child to participate. And one of our recommendations to IPCC that they're struggling with is the argument that you should be able to participate remotely.
Yes.
But I must say, we tried some of that at a recent meeting recently, and you know, video conferencing is still deeply problematic.
Yeah, it's not the same. You're
right. Getting connections, even in the sort of most modern university, we still don't have that down. And there's also that when you're writing these really intense reports and trying to synthesize a lot of information and get consensus, there is nothing like the interpersonal, like going out for dinner together, you know, eating lunch together, that can bring a group together and produce better science.
And sometimes it's where real change happens. Even with our team, we all work remotely. And when we are together, the creativity, the synergy, the energy, it's different than all of us being on a phone and Zoom and doing Zoom.
But
it's not the same.
Maybe they could mix it in a little bit more.
Maybe
we're just a few years from the perfect video conference and we'll all be there in avatars and able to feel like we're there in person.
I love that visual. Oh my gosh. You also asked survey participants specifically about the role of gender in being a climate scientist. And how did they respond about that? What did they find for their experience?
So there we had at least half the women saying that they felt that gender had been a barrier in their career. And they definitely thought it. I mean, so let me just back up. One of the most interesting findings is that when we asked women about their own experience, they were quite positive. They said they hadn't encountered many barriers. But then we did think to ask them about their perception of other women's experience. And they saw other women having lots of problems. So they don't think they have a problem, but all the other women do. And apparently this is reflected in the broader literature on gender, where women can often deny their own experience, but they're very empathetic to seeing other women's experience. So, but in general, in the broader question about whether gender had been a barrier in their career, many of them felt that it had, and many felt that there were still problems around gender in climate science. And I would say that that's true, just based on my own experience as a scientist, and particularly watching the experience of my students as they go into their career paths.
We're going to be fighting for change until I pass over to greener pastures or something. I mean, I think about when I became a women's activist. I was like 21 years old working on Wall Street. Mm. And what happened is I picked up a copy of Ms. Magazine, which was not the big thing in my family. And it was like I read things that stayed with me to this day about inequality. And I think we've made progress when it comes to women, but we've got a long way to go. The report is not all negative, and you give recommendations for how to change things or how to help improve or strengthen the many voices being left out. Can you highlight a few of them for me?
Yes. So obviously remote participation is important. the recommendations actually came from a survey question where we asked the women, what would you recommend? They talked about gender sensitivity training at the early meetings when you become an author. They talked about maybe finding a way to bring in early career women as sort of participants more, a mentoring system where more experienced women could help other women, translation possibilities, but that's a problem in terms of financing and how many languages do you translate into, because one of the things about IPCC is it is very international. And as the number of women has grown to, you know, the 25-30% authors, also the number of people from different parts of the world has grown. So there are more and more authors now from Latin America, Africa, and Asia than there were in the first reports. And so that adds to some of the language barriers. Childcare help. Those were all some of the suggestions that were made, but people also talked about needing, you know, much broader structural change, keeping women in STEM education, making sure that there's a pipeline of women, and then just changing the dynamics of some of the meetings where you make sure that everybody has a voice. And that's to do with who's chairing those meetings.
It's interesting to me how we all go back to a relevant experience in our life, and sometimes they're painful. And I refer to when I went to this Cultivating Women's Leadership training, and they made us read a book and watch a video on white privilege. And I was really offended. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. You know, I'm not prejudiced. Well, that training opened my mind forever. Mm-hmm. Once your mind is open, hopefully it doesn't, you know, close like a steel trap. But that's what you're saying. It was not an awareness that I had of what white privilege really means and how it can affect things. And sometimes in our family, I'll say something, or one of the kids will, or my husband will say, that's white privilege. Like, why? Mm-hmm. Well, why can't they just get a babysitter? Well, there you go. Maybe they can't afford it. Those kind of things that are not mean-spirited, but it's a lack of awareness about other people's situations.
Yeah, and in talking to a group recently about the paper, a group of men and women, climate scientists, I mean, one of our recognitions is when you're a scientist, you're deeply passionate about what you do. You really care. And so what often happens in these meeting dynamics is the men are not intentionally talking over the women. They just really care about what they're saying, and they really want to help the world. And they just forget common courtesies about who speaks. And I'm a pretty loud, confident woman, and I know I do it to other people as well. I have to consciously sometimes tell myself to shut up, especially after writing this paper. It's almost paralyzed me in some groups because I'm so aware of making sure the person that doesn't speak English well gets to speak, and the North-South dynamics of the sort of Europeans and North Americans dominating the discussion. So,
but that's a wonderful thing. I mean, that's that awareness. I mean, it's really good because you now are aware and taking time to help raise all voices.
But it makes me irritable that when I see other people not doing
Yes, I resemble that remark. I shared one story with you before we got on air. It's like, you know, we talked about someone who has no sense of awareness of what he did, but it's there. So just a little bit more about the reaction, not just from the IPCC to the report, but the climate scientists, the community in general. How has it been received?
Yeah. Well, one of the most exciting things was that I'm currently an IPCC author.
Love it. So now you know if it had an impact or not.
I had been in the past. So I will say, actually, when you asked about why we wrote the paper, I was an IPCC author when I was quite a junior scientist, and I observed some of these dynamics myself and experienced it. Now I'm much more senior, and I'm fortunate to be one of the US nominees for a special report on whether we can keep global warming under 1.5 degrees C. And I've now been to 4 author meetings. I'm what's called a lead author of Chapter 5, which means I'm a major author, but we have chapter leads, called chapter lead authors. And this report has 38% women authors.
That's a big jump.
It is.
It's really a big
woo. And some wonderful women who are leading the whole process. But amazingly, at our very first author meeting, it was International Women's Day. We were meeting in Brazil. And I happened to mention to someone that we just got the results of the survey. And they said, why don't you get up and present it to all the authors? And so I got the opportunity to present the early results to all of the authors of the report I'm involved with. Some of them said it made them much more aware of and has affected things. But then, really excitingly, right before our last meeting in Botswana last month, I got an email saying that IPCC's decided to establish a gender task force. And a little bit inspired by our paper, but I also think inspired by the number of women who are in leadership positions in IPCC. So they're actually going to have a gender task force now over the next year or so, which will make recommendations for the next big report for the sixth assessment. So I can't think of a better reaction. I mean, Mimi is thrilled that, you know, as a graduate student, she's written a paper that has had an impact on this important international community. And I've definitely been contacted. I've had some amazing emails, and so has Mimi, from women who read the paper and empathized with it or want to add to the stories. But it's part of a larger literature on women's experience as scientists. And you know, there are groups like 500 Women Scientists. There's a branch in Tucson. So, you know, I feel like we're part of a movement, but it's really rewarding to see the institution itself respond to some of the things that we suggest in the paper.
And what makes me thrilled is that we now have over 200,000 listeners to our podcast in a quarter. And though these people are, it keeps growing and they're engaged and learning this. It's that awareness that makes me so excited about spreading the word about things like this. And it's not in any way mean-spirited. It's all about, it's better for all of us when everyone's voice is heard.
Because then, and nobody's given me a hard time about the paper.
That's really
great.
None of
the men who were involved with IPCC, they've actually said, well, I wish you'd interviewed men as well, because I'm sure men are facing barriers, particularly around these intersectional categories of being from the developing world or being of a different race. But mostly people have been supportive and said that it's affected their awareness of their interactions in these sorts of committees. So it's great.
It is great. So my next question is definitely one of those ask one of the climate scientists you respect most in the world kind of question, which I believe actually affirms or validates your research. But I did mention my interview with Faith Gamill from the Intuit people up in Alaska, United States of America, everybody. Okay, they're United States citizens. And what she described on the show is literally land melting out from under them, where they have lived forever. Like, how do you explain that? From the beginning of time, they've lived there. The ice is melting. Men go out to hunt. They don't come back because they fall through the ice, because it's never melted in the times they go. You know, the risk of the caribou population by the Alaska, the Arctic Preserve up there. And my question is, why aren't we hearing about it? These are our citizens. Like, I'm going to put you on the spot, and maybe you have the answer to that. I'd like to know the biggest threat that our civilization has ever faced, in my opinion, is global warming. Plain and simple. There, it takes no prisoners. It doesn't care about how much you make. If you make more, you'll be able to, you know, mitigate your impact a little bit out. But there'll come a point where everybody's lives, to me, are already being impacted. What's going on with, why don't people care? Where is the national media on this issue?
Well, that's a really tough question.
I know.
So I've been a climate scientist, I hate to say it, for almost 40 years. And we've been warning people that long. And I think should I keep talking?
Yes.
Oh, sorry. I think that we've just said it too many times. And where people think, yeah, I heard that, but the world didn't fall apart. And what they're not hearing is that each time we do a report, we're saying it's going to be worse. And the report I'm working on right now for IPCC about whether we can keep warming below 1.5 C, that's like 3 degrees Fahrenheit, the answer is going to be no. I mean, we've looked at everything that we could do to prevent that warming. We can get there, but we're going to have to go through what we call overshoot. It's going to get warmer before we can bring it back down again. And we're looking at, you know, how fast could people change in order to stop the warming now? And we've got sort of a built-in momentum. So we're facing a tough scenario, and that's why I really believe we have to focus on adaptation and helping people cope. People are
and talk about that a little bit. That's really important about what you say, because you have mentioned that in things when I've heard you speak, not focusing on stopping it. Well, yes, but the adaptation. Talk about that a little bit.
So what can we do to help these communities where the Arctic ice is melting under them? What we can we do to help the island communities that are being inundated by sea level rise? And, you know, should they be compensated? Should we help them move? And it's not just people, it's species as well. What are we going to do about species that are losing their habitat? And I just feel that we're not paying enough attention and not giving enough money to helping think through adaptation to climate change. And it's interesting because here in Tucson, we actually live in high temperatures, and there are, I think, strategies we can share with people about how to adapt to living in a warmer climate. But we need to make sure that the strategies we share are not the ones that involve lots of air conditioning based on fossil fuels.
Right.
So I just feel that adaptation is an absolute priority. And that, unfortunately, several governments, not just the US, but the Australian and others, have actually cut adaptation funding in the last few years. And that just seems to be terrible.
I don't want to be sarcastic, but you know it's only going to get better in our country. It's like there's not good news.
We've got an election coming up in November.
We will. That's right. That's the hope that we're all holding on to. The next question is, we'll shift gears a little bit because I really want to give time to talk about the Carson Scholars Program, because it is a piece of this, a very important piece of this. And it was, I think it's safe to say, it was your baby. And look what is happening. And it's impacted my life. I mean, I spent hours with Ashwin recently, who is, you know, the fishing cat conservancy. I mean, he has his own conservancy and he's invited me to go to India. But that was because of the Carson Scholars Program. So share with us, what is it about? What was your vision for it?
So we created the Carson Scholars Program for graduate students at the University of Arizona to help them better communicate their science, their environmental science.
So needed.
Because we feel that communication is really important. And we give about a dozen scholarships each year. Also, it helps them survive because graduate students don't make a lot of money. But we give them a training course in how to communicate. And what's really exciting now that we're going into the seventh year, I think, is that we've trained, you know, 60, 70 students, and they've really gone on to make a difference. And many of them are working on climate change. Many of them now have written better research proposals and gotten these wonderful scholarships. Many of them are now teaching about climate at other universities. So I feel really good about the program, both the effect it's had on the students themselves, but also on what they've then gone on to do. So Ashwin's one example, but, you know, we have people who've gone to work for the Department of Energy. We have people who are professors at the University of California. And the Carson program's been part of what has helped them succeed. And it's something I think we have to make a commitment to. We train students in science, but we don't always train them to communicate that science. And that communication helps their careers, and it helps them be better scientists, but also better citizens.
It's more important now, I think, almost than ever. So much of what is being written about in different disciplines is the storytelling piece. How do you tell your story?
Yeah.
Because it's really crowded space. So it's really important. Have you seen cases where, and I just have to, you know, go back to the many presentations I've heard and broadcasts, and, you know, my husband has come with me, friends, and you sit there in awe of what these young minds are doing, accomplishing their areas of study, its mm-hmm. impact for the planet. I mean, it's very impactful and mind-boggling in some ways.
And one of the things relating to the topic of our interview today is that the majority of Carson scholars have been women, but we've also had a significant number of people from the developing world, like Saleh Ahmed, who's working on climate vulnerability in Bangladesh. I'm so glad we've been able to support his work in perhaps the most vulnerable country in the world. And then we've had Native American Carson scholars who have done amazing work. So I feel as though we're the program is in the spirit of this larger number of voices being able to speak.
And being raised up.
Yeah, just America, Lutz Ley, from Mexico, absolutely incredible. And I was so proud just a few weeks ago where she basically chaired a visit from Noam Chomsky talking about climate change. And she was like up there on the stage and she said, I couldn't have done it without the Carson Scholarship.
And I know that's true.
Yeah.
Because public speaking is a skill set.
Yeah.
And to be able to tell your story will help you get funding. It will help you get published. It will help you get just donors that want to support your important work.
And that's important because the Carson Fellowship is funded by generous donors who care about young people and care about the environment. And we're incredibly grateful to those people that do support the scholarship because we couldn't do it without our supporters.
But it's one of those things where once you hear them and really kind of get your head around their impact, you want to support it because mm-hmm. it's almost selfish. Like it's in my best interest to support them because they might be coming up with solutions that'll help save my grandchildren's lives. And I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
It's like there's a selfless but a very selfish part, and their stories are so compelling. Do you have any stories where their experience in the Carson Scholars Program changed their trajectory that they were on, that they did this and then they decided, oh, well, you know, I think I'm going to go into, you know, lobbying because I love making the case for this. God forbid they thought about that. But I mean, have you seen any where it's changed the path?
I think the main way it's changed people is they've become more interdisciplinary. I think that the natural and social scientists, they've come from both backgrounds, have got more respect for each other. So I think that's been an important change because it's interdisciplinarity that's going to solve these really, really complex problems. I don't know, there was the one scholar that ran for office for the Cherokee Nation. But you know, so it's often hard to say, oh, this happened because of this. I know for a couple of my own students have gotten Carson scholarships, and the biggest impact has been their improved communication skills, which has helped them get other scholarships and helped them get jobs.
It's a forever thing.
Yeah, and some of them have been able to use the funds to go work in other parts of the world, which they otherwise couldn't have done. Meg Mills-Navoa, who's a current Carson scholar, she was able, because of the scholarship, to go to Panama and volunteer for the UN Development Program and wrote a report reviewing all of their adaptation projects in Latin America. She never could have done that without the extra support.
So it's a ripple effect. It's not just one thing where they have this experience. It's a skill set that they get. As I've said, like writing an op-ed, it's a skill set and you have to learn how to do it. So they have it. Once you have it, you have it. Let's go to a little bit of, is there anything else you'd like to share about the Carson Scholars Program? I'd kind of like to know, when you select them, are you looking for certain areas? Like, do you want someone that's studying water or someone that's studying food? Or is it really the quality of their presentation? How are they selected?
Well, they have to write an application where they have to talk about the science. So we want to make sure they're doing really good research. So that's part of it. And it needs to be on the environment. But we also want to see that they have a commitment to communication and that they know what it is that they're lacking. So we don't pick by, oh, we need a water person or we need a forest person. We're looking for the very best young environmental scientists who we feel could really benefit from the training and from the support, who have a commitment to public outreach and sharing their research, and we want to help them do that better. It's always really hard to pick. I mean, we get...
I cannot imagine. I would not want that job.
From across the university, and, you know, they're great. I wish we could fund all of them. But part of the value of the program is it is a fairly intimate program with just 12 people. And we have three faculty who are completely devoted to the program and spend a lot of time. And then people like you and other people in the community who interact with them. And the other thing I like is the way we've been able to integrate them into community programs. So the fact that they give talks about their research in the Borderlands Brewery, you know, that's a very challenging audience. That's awesome.
It is.
Yeah. And then now we've got a program with the Arizona Sonora Desert Museum where they talk about their work at the museum and at Biosphere 2. So this is great for the community that we can provide these great speakers, but it's also wonderful for them to have to stand up in front of these different audiences.
It's a real win-win-win. And just talk about a feel-good program in a very crowded space in terms of getting funding. I mean, it's always, it's that never-ending thing, especially at the university. There's vying for dollars. So I think you've done an unbelievable job developing private donors who once they're hooked, they're hooked. It's like, I believe
in
this.
And I'm very grateful, and it makes, I feel really good about the program.
It is. I feel really good about being a part of it. So let's go to what I call, I want to end up on a positive note. I really do with all of my shows, but there is to me what I call a very sad current state of affairs. And just as I was prepping for the show, Scott Pruitt, who's the EPA administrator, proposed a rule that would seriously change how the EPA makes decisions. And of course, it attacks the science. It would prevent the EPA from using scientific, I can't even say this with a straight face, from using scientific studies where the underlying data is not available to the public. So doesn't that sound good, full disclosure? Well, not really. And when I dug a little deeper, a lot of the researchers and scientists that worked on some of the research on pesticides, for example, their jobs and livelihood and you know, higher ability would be impacted if it was disclosed that they were part of this damning study saying this is horrible. When that happens, what happens in terms of the long-range effect? I keep thinking about some of these things, like if we devastate bears' ears for uranium, that's Humpty Dumpty. You don't put it back together. You don't plant trees over the mess that is created. There's no place to put the uranium tailings. As a scientist, are we doing things today from which there will be no recovery? I that's a heavy-duty question to ask you, but I had to. I have Diana in the studio.
Well, yeah, I think we are doing things that are irreversible. I mean, extinction's pretty irreversible with species.
That's final.
Taking something out of being a national park or a national forest. I mean, part of the reason I came to this country was my admiration for America's protection of its wildlands, particularly in the West. So I hate at any time that that great sort of like crown in America's history is in any way affected. But going back to the sort of question of you know, data availability and evidence-based decision-making. The people I feel worse for right now are some of the scientists that are working within the government who are not allowed to write about climate change anymore and whose work has to be approved. I mean, we want the very best scientists being allowed to advise the government without fear for their jobs. And so that's part of what's really worries me at the moment is, you know, you're even getting federal agencies writing to universities where they've given grants saying, could you take the word climate out of your abstract? And they're doing that to protect us in case the funding was cut because climate was in the abstract. And I mean, we've got those letters that, that we know that we've received them. So I think that that's perhaps of greater concern than this. We have to share the data. The biggest problem with making your data available, it's like the survey that we've been talking about, is people were honest with us because we promised to protect their privacy. We don't put any names on things. And if you say the public has to see everything, including the names of the people we interview,
they won't speak.
They won't tell us what's going on, and then we won't have that knowledge. So, and, you know, it's the same with a lot of health service. We need to protect people's privacy whilst doing the science. And we can make the data available at certain aggregate levels, but there's sort of a contradiction there. We want to share all of our data, but to get some of that data, you have to protect privacy.
And see, to me, the most important thing is trusting the source. And I do trust the EPA. And I just had a friend come here last week from the EPA, and we spent hours. We split a bottle of wine on a Tuesday night, living dangerously, but we had to talk all night pretty much about what was going on. And she said, she's a longtime EPA employee, and she said, you know, Gina, the EPA standards are pretty much low. They don't have a really high bar. Mm-hmm. They're not restrictive enough, as far as she is concerned, in terms of harm to us and the environment and plants and animals and water. She said they're really minimal standards, and they've had major dramatic effects on things like our water, clean water. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about relaxing them, the missing piece for me is, how do people not put the pieces together that it's going to impact their health and the river where they take their kids swimming and the fish that they go fishing for and the animals that they might hunt or want to just go observe, the national parks in which they hike?
Well, I think two things are going on. One is that people have, certain people have made a good argument or convinced people that somehow environmental protection means job loss. And that's not true. We know that
it's absolutely not true.
Environmental protection can create
by
jobs.
The numbers.
Yeah. The other thing is, I wonder, when we relax a regulation, who are we relaxing it for? I mean, you and I both work with the private sector and the corporate world. I've worked with some pretty, you know, big global corporations, and they believe in environmental protection.
They do.
So I'm not sure that some of the world's major corporations who employ people want regulations to be weaker. They've got longer term visions, and they understand that you can't undermine the world that your economy is built on. So what worries me is that many of these regulations are being relaxed, and that we're our country's not doing anything, not doing what it should at the federal level about climate change, in the interests of a very few people that are not necessarily the big job creators.
So you have absolutely global, international experience, contacts, conversations ongoing. You travel extensively.
Try not to overdo it.
Try not to overdo it, yeah.
Because of the carbon footprint.
Where in the world is Diana? But yeah, that's a whole other conversation, but you're conscious of it, and carbon credits and all of that. But I can't help but ask someone that is around the world from time to time, what is the global community, not just the scientific community, what are they saying that's not in the newspapers about the behavior of the United States as it relates specifically to the environment? The first day out of the chute, the first thing that came across the news was they were removing climate change from every website, that phrase, every website that's related to the office of the president.
Well, I would say, I mean, I just came back from an IPCC meeting with 100 people from different countries. And, you know, people are worried about the federal stance on climate, but people understand that that's not the American people. And
that's
so
awesome.
Most people know that California still takes climate change very seriously, that the majority of the American public care about climate change, including many, many Republicans. They know that cities are taking action on climate change. And they know that American innovation and technology is sort of taking us ahead in terms of solar and batteries and things like that. So I think people recognize that what's going on in Washington does not reflect everything in America, even though it has a big influence on it. And I think we're going to be reducing our emissions whatever they do in Washington, however much money they gave the coal industry, the coal industry's on its way out.
And even people in the coal industry say that. We don't want this.
Yeah.
They're looking at other things to do with coal, and it's
so
just...
So I actually think we may make some of our climate commitments, even though the leadership at the moment doesn't want to. And I don't feel like I have to be too embarrassed about our country. I am an American citizen as well as a British citizen. And I'm really glad that people are willing to understand that it's a very diverse country.
Right, and that it's embarrassing to us at times. So this was, to me, delightful. You ended up on a positive note. There is hope. People are finding their voices. States and cities are taking leadership positions and saying, no, that's not what we want. So, Diana Liverman, thank you for showing up in my life and for taking the time to be here. May 24th, Ernie Garcia and Hector Sylvain on our local show, a winning partnership with the Tucson Urban League and Tucson Electric Power. And then May 29th, the fifth in our five-part series, spotlighting women leading the charge, Dr. Catherine Hayhoe. And I can't wait for that. Climate Solutions.
She's amazing.
She is amazing. Everybody, make it a great green day and keep that consciousness raised. We need all of us. Thank you.